All right, welcome everybody. This is the last lunchtime learning series of the at least the academic calendar, and so I thank everybody for being here today. I think this is the second or third year, maybe third year that we've done these sort of ending the semester with some readings, so suggestions of books that maybe people want to read over the summer, or just books that people have found to be useful in terms of their lives as educators, or even just to enrich their understanding of the financial topics that we talk about so often on these calls. We're going to talk about four different books today. These are suggestions that actually came from members of the financial security team. These are books that are generally in the sort of quote-unquote popular press, so these are things you can find at a bookstore or online. They're not designed for a academic audience. They're actually designed to be read by a broader set of regular people. And they're all books that we think have some application to the work of financial educators. In some cases, it can be by providing examples that could be used in education, or maybe they help summarize some of the evidence around a certain area. So I think it's a range of different ways that these kinds of books can be useful to folks. They're generally pretty affordable. These are books that are available in, oftentimes in a paperback version and can be had for, $20 or less in some cases, or you can find them readily used. The books that we'll be talking about today are all relatively new releases. Some are a little older, but they're sort of gaining popularity. They're still getting a lot of sales in terms of the bestsellers list. So we're going to talk about four altogether. The first one we'll talk about is the I Will Teach You to Be Rich. The second one is a book called Life and Debt, A Fresh Approach to Achieving Financial Wellness. The third is The Opposite of Being Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And then the fourth is called Falling Short, Becoming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. Our call today is about an hour long. Our general approach is going to be that each book will be reviewed by an educator, and then there'll be some time for a little bit of discussion, and we'll then move on to the next book, and I'll try to keep time as a moderator. And then we'll save a little bit of time at the end for cross-cutting comments across the four books. Other books that you might suggest that we think about or that are related to the books that we're talking about today, or even books that we should be putting on our horizon for a future call like this. So before I begin, I want to pause and see if anybody has any questions before we get started. Just to clarify, there is no brief for today's call. So normally for these lunchtime learning calls, we would have a PDF brief that summarizes the research on a particular topic. Today we don't. So the books are available and you can pick them up, but mainly what we'll have today is the audio recording of the call. So within a few days after today, there'll be an MP3 file that's uploaded on the website fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series, probably with some links to the books as well, but also most importantly to the links to the audio file of the discussion itself. All right, anything I've forgotten from any of our presenters, or should we go ahead and kick it off? All right, hearing none, I'm going to hand it off to Colin O'Rourke, who's done a lot of work with the team over the years and is a staff here at the Center for Financial Security. I think he's standing in a little bit or co-presenting with Sherry Daniels from Portage County, and they're going to talk about the I Will Teach You to Be Rich. So take it away.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to be talking about I Will Teach You to Be Rich. It's a book by Rumi Sethi, and I'm going to bounce back and forth a little bit between Sherry Daniels' notes and my own notes. Hopefully I'm clear. I don't want to be speaking on behalf of Sherry, but she and I largely agree with our reviews of the book. And just a little bit of background, Rumi, he's started as a blogger. He has a blog with the same title, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. I checked it out the other day. It seems like he's branched off a little bit more recently. He does, online courses, oftentimes about entrepreneurship. And the blog isn't necessarily as much anymore about personal finance as it was a few years ago when he wrote this book. I think this book was first published around 2009 or 2010 and was a bestseller. So to get into the review, I'm going to start largely with Sherry's comments, again, which I parallel many of my own thoughts about the book. So the book is really geared towards a younger audience of 20 to 35-year-olds. It kind of has a particular tone to kind of give you a flavor for that. And a quote from the book is, if you do this, shop for higher interest rates for your savings account, you're a moron. So he kind of uses that type of tone throughout the book, which is, Sherry and I think, appealing to this age group. The book covers a wide variety of financial topics that everyone needs to know. And Sherry notes that although the book is targeted for the specific age group of younger adults, many adults that she works with through the financial wellness program in Portage County just don't understand the concepts adequately. So the book includes a 6-week program for someone to follow and to help them streamline their financial management and save time. There are specific recommended action steps for each week. And a major point that Ramit makes from the beginning is that getting started is more important than becoming an expert. So he says things like, set up a good enough system and then get on with your life and get your financial system, what he says, is 85% right, and then kind of move on. To kind of walk through what each of those 6 weeks is about, so week one is about optimizing credit cards, and kind of getting your credit card fees waived. Week two is setting up an online, at least he kind of pushes an online high interest savings account. Week three, opening a 401k and investment account. Week four, kind of budgeting, figure out how much you're spending and making your money go where you want it to go. Yeah, he really focuses a lot on opportunity costs. The idea that it's not bad to spend money, just target it towards the things that are most important to you. Week five is about automating your accounts, and week six is about investing. And the key point there is that he's very much against trying to pick stocks, but instead promotes low-cost index funds for investing. Some thoughts from Sherry. She thinks that credit history is well explained, including the differences between a credit score and report. And included is the background and why both a credit history and a score are needed and used. There are good excerpts within the book, which help to explain some concepts. Ramit explains them in this way. I asked some of the bloggers I trust and admire to add their 2 cents to the book. Look for their contributions scattered throughout. She especially liked the specific action steps that included estimated times for completion. For example, week one, step one, get your credit report and credit score. Ramit estimates that this will take an hour. So kind of throughout the book, it gives very concrete action steps for each week, each of the 6 weeks in this program, and then an associated time with them. And then a couple final notes from Sherry before I get into some of my own notes. A very misunderstood financial concept, especially for this age group, is 401ks. This book does a good job explaining why young people should get one now. The benefits of having an employer match are discussed. And then there are 2 areas that Sherry believes Ramit goes above and beyond other financial books that she's read. First, he writes about how to elevate your goals beyond the day-to-day. When your finances are above spending your time handling the day-to-day issues of money, you should give back to the community that helped you flourish. And then secondly, he writes about how money has an effect on relationships, for example, the importance of communicating with parents or significant others when it comes to finances. So those are Sherry's comments. I'll just add a few of my own. So one thing that Ramit talks a lot about, and I'm not sure I I don't do this in my own life very much, but he makes a note of it throughout the book, is basically to negotiate everything. So, to call your credit card companies and to ask for lower fees, maybe more people do this, call your cable company and negotiate, your monthly fee, and then also negotiating things like auto loans, mortgages. So this idea of negotiating, and he claims that he saved tons of money doing that. And he kind of gives some scripts or suggested letters, about how to go about doing that. One thing maybe a criticism is that I think that the book is in some ways maybe too individualistic or too individualized. So for example, he has a section about how to pay off your credit card debt, but it doesn't at all give any information about potentially seeking, an outside advisor or a credit counselor. It's all just kind of do it yourself. So it's, in some ways that this kind of do-it-yourself model could be empowering, but in other cases you may understate the need for seeking outside advice. One thing I really like about the book is that he focuses a lot on automating your finances. So this probably appeals across a wide range of age groups, but potentially specifically to younger adults. So setting up auto deposits and to savings and to investments and just automating as much as possible. He has a chapter, or at least a section, called The Myth of Financial Expertise. That title may be a little broad, but really what he's talking about there is the paying people to kind of pick stocks or paying people for investment advice instead of just using low-fee index funds. He's kind of financial expertise makes it sound like he's referring to more than just kind of stock picking, but he's really focused on that. And then one thing that I've kind of been thinking about the past few days after I reread the book is he makes a point late in the book, don't let Uncle Sam make your investment decisions. And basically what he means by that is to not get too hung up on like tax breaks and things like that, and instead to just start saving. I think there's probably something to that. Some things like a Roth IRA, it does seem useful to set up, and that largely it can save in taxes and other expenses over time, but I kind of wonder whether sometimes people may get too bogged down in the details, and that just may prevent them from getting started saving or investing. Michael, I think that's all I have, all Sherry and I have.
Great. Anybody have any questions? Or are you, if you're familiar with the book, if you want to throw your 2 cents in on it. Colin and Anne, would you recommend this as a book for educators?
I would. I think that the main weakness at this point of the book is that at some points he gets way too specific about financial products. So, for example, he recommends specific bank accounts and even specific credit cards. I don't believe that he's getting any type of, like, kickback, or there's no conflict of interest, I don't think, but it just makes the material seem dated when he gets into that level of detail about specific products. One other thing I want to mention is that, and it kind of parallels the book, blanking on the name right now, but by Elaine Olin, from a couple of years, that was reviewed a couple of years ago.
Pound Foolish?
Yeah, Pound Foolish, is that he also, really criticizes the idea of this saving $3, kind of the, I think it's termed the latte factor, saving $3 on coffee or a latte every day. He's largely focused on, he criticizes focusing on those types of expenses, and instead kind of encourages focusing on what he calls just big wins. And that kind of goes into what I was saying about his encouragement to negotiate everything.
Great. Other questions or comments on our first book? All right. So the next book we have is Life and Debt. It's interesting, the author calls herself a debt therapist, which is a new profession to me, at least. I haven't heard that term before. I think Marianne's going to lead us through a discussion of life and debt.
I am, thanks. Yeah, the book has a little additional title. It's Learn to Love Your Debt. So that's really the focus of the book, change your relationship with debt and you change your life. The author is Leslie Tane. She is an attorney and, as you mentioned, a debt therapist. I didn't do a lot of research into how she calls herself a debt therapist, but part of it is she went through her own time when she was in large debt and worked herself out of it. So the book I found easy to read. I think it had a lot of good common sense ideas in it, and a lot of it is what we share, I think, with our financial clients too. So in Life and Debt, Leslie is really trying to teach how to change our perspective on money. So I think it's more of how to look at our debt and look at our money, our income, and our expenses and our savings, and change from maybe a negative thought process to positive. So especially for people that are in debt and are under a lot of stress, I would recommend this book if they're so inclined to read. It was easy to read. It's 152 pages, and it was written this year, so everything is up to date. So the author is really trying to help us think about debt, and not so negatively, but actually to embrace it and to change the thought process around it. So she talks about realistic budgeting, paying bills on time, paying off bad debt, and basically she says all debt is good debt until we are no longer able to pay it, and then it becomes bad debt. She encourages readers to have a savings account and uses positive reinforcement, because her end goal is for everyone to have financial freedom. She divides the book into four sections. The first is talking about what is debt, what is good debt versus bad debt, looking at all the different types of debt, and fitting debt into our budget. And then the second section of the book talks about the budget, how to confront the fear of budgeting and why budgeting is essential, how to create a budget, fixing budget mistakes, and she has sample budgets. She also has, actually I'll refer you to a couple websites. There is a website for the book. It is called lifeanddebtbook.com, and that has some reviews on it, an overview, talks about the author and how you can contact her. The second thing that she includes in the book for readers is there's actually a website called budgetjewel.com, and that takes you straight to her law group, which I find interesting, and she provides a passcode for people that have bought the book. However, when I put my email and password in, it said that it was incorrect, and it's like, okay, I know I have the right password, so I don't quite understand that, and I could email her. Anyway, so I thought it was interesting that it went straight to her own personal business. It does say for a low fee of $9.99, they will maintain this system and provide a service to those people that haven't bought the book. But, as I said, I really didn't look into that too much or review that. So getting back to the sections of the book, the third section is credit. And she says that credit is a necessary evil of life, and that in this section we'll learn all the things that we need to know about credit. She includes the credit reports and how to access credit reports, and also how credit score is calculated. Just talks about why credit is so important, what affects our credit, also talks about debt collection, and how to get and read our credit reports. The fourth section is the next step. So if we have debt, how do we reduce it? She talks a lot about breaking credit card addiction. And one of the things I liked about that was that she actually refers people to debtorsanonymous.org, which I had never heard of before, and I thought that was interesting. She actually has a six-step program for breaking credit card addiction, and she really recommends that if a person believes they have an addiction to spending or acquiring too many credit cards, and how many of us have worked with people or know somebody that is in that situation, there actually is a debtorsanonymous.org. She talks about planning for the unexpected, which again is something that we talk about with our clients, and also just the six steps to reducing debt-related stress. She talks about setting long-term goals after we go through making a budget and why budgeting is so essential and looking at our credit and getting our credit score and dealing with our debts, then setting some long-term goals. And then celebrating leaving the paycheck-to-paycheck lifestyle behind. Some of the other things that I thought made the book easy to read and interesting, it's really like she's talking to you personally. She does include some life and debt tips, which were just positive, encouraging, and good insights. For example, some of the tips are, there's no shame in having financial trouble. Learn the responsibility that comes with student loans. Keep a written copy of the original payment. Never use a 401k as an ATM. And stay in the black by not spending more than you have. And then another life and debt tip under fitting debt into your budget is the secret to managing your debt begins with your budget. Excuse me. And that budgeting has only one rule. Do not go over budget. Aha. And budgeting is easy, fun, and rewarding. So all through the book, she's really positive. It is written for any age group, I would say, young adults or adults through mature adults, any income level. So it's a pretty generalized book with some good information on, like, how do we get our credit score, how can we budget, what do budgets look like. So it's pretty overall easy to understand. I didn't see anything that she was really pushing. She only mentioned the website that I talked about once, so she didn't keep on referring to that, just in, you know, one portion of a chapter. She does also talk about recognizing if you are a victim of identity theft and what to do with that, and really strongly encourages throughout the book several times about getting credit reports and explaining the sections of the credit reports and what to do if you find a mistake. So I think everything was really, it wasn't opinionated. It was something that I think we're teaching now, so it's a good generalized book for someone. I would say the only thing is it's like there isn't a time, as in the other book, it gives you 6 weeks. So I could see somebody maybe read the first chapter, put it down, and you know, it's not real goal-oriented as to do this, and this is exactly how you do it and when you should do it by. So I would recommend it, you know, especially I think if I would have a client come in and maybe they're interested in doing some work on their own, this is a book that is real common sense and has everything right there within the book itself. So any questions?
Hi, Marianne. You had mentioned in one of her chapters, she talked about the fear of budgeting and pitfalls. I'm wondering if there's anything that jumps out at you in terms of like the fears or the pitfalls that you found interesting.
Well, see, I think she really talks about all through the book really facing or overcoming, you know, some people really avoid budgeting or even their debt, like, okay, I'm not going to pay this bill. So I guess I need to go back and take a look here. I would say she probably takes that and makes the reader feel like it really is normal to fear budgeting. It's normal to be afraid of your debt, so to speak, or norm, you know, I don't know if normal is the right word, but she makes it feel like it's okay to feel the feelings, but move forward. So, for example, some of the advice she gives is maybe it's using technology or maybe it's just using a piece of paper, but go ahead and write down, confront your fears. She says 80% of clients that come to her have never budgeted. Maybe they're unsure of how to get started. So she just assures them that they've made the right decision in seeking help. And then she shows them how to put their financial life on track. So she starts with two questions. How much do you earn every month and how much do you spend? So I think we're doing that with the clients that we work with. And she talks about needs versus wants. And so she really doesn't spend a lot of time on that as far as confronting the fear. But I would say the feeling throughout the book is normalizing or making it feel like, oh gosh, if I'm in debt, I'm not the only one. You know, sometimes people come in and they feel like they're alone in their debt. But she really makes a person feel like, it's, you know, it's okay. It's normal to have debt. It's how you handle your debt that really counts. I don't know if that answers your question, but she really doesn't go into a lot of details. She does talk about staying motivated, and there's a lot of good stories throughout the book as far as making a person feel or see what other people may be going through with debt and some of the situations that they get into or how they get out of it.
Thank you. No, that is helpful. I think about in terms of our own work with a lot of normalizing and examples and, you know, that whole peer support kind of thing. Thanks.
Exactly, right. And that's one of the reasons I really like this book is because there is a lot of normalizing in it, lots of stories. Actually, I'd like to, because you can send her an email, I would like to send her one and just ask if I could use some of her stories. And, you know, when I'm working with clients or if I'm teaching a class, because they're good stories. Real commonplace.
Great. Any other questions on this one?
Yep, so I would say this is a great book for any age. College students, you spend some time on student loans and, you know, just anybody in any situation could read this.
Great. And again, this is it's available in paperback. I think it's, you know, $12 or $13, so definitely an accessible one. The next book is actually a book that's gotten, at least I've seen it in the press quite a bit, perhaps because the author is a New York Times columnist, and that probably helps get your book out there. It's called The Opposite of Being Spoiled, and so Ruth is going to share her comments and feedback of her read of it.
Great. Thanks, Michael. So I did read The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And just like Michael said, it's been in the press lately, and I just got an email from Mary Campbell Wood, who shared the link to the author interview on Wisconsin Public Radio, and that was just aired on May 5th and May 10th. And if I'd had another hour, I would have absolutely listened to it to hear more from the author himself. The copyright is 2015, and the author is Ron Lieber, L-I-E-B-E-R. And he is a personal finance columnist for the New York Times. He's been in that position since 2008. But he was previously a personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And another thing that makes him an authority on this topic is that he is a dad of a 10-year-old daughter. I thought the content of this book was really interesting. Sounds like Marianne's book to a certain extent, because it was based on real live families, lots of interviews, referrals, his own version of research. And he starts off by, I guess his disclaimer, the assumption is that most of the readers will have household incomes of about $50,000 a year. So his assumption was that most readers would have household incomes of $50,000 a year, although he goes on to suggest that households with lower or higher incomes will also find it relevant. I had to keep going back to that because some of the examples or illustrations he shared were just so totally over the top, like the $20,000 kid parties and that kind of thing. That doesn't happen in Iowa County. Maybe it happens in other places in our state. And there were other examples that were so very real, almost like he was checking out like Facebook pages for my friends and family, because it was just certainly examples that we could relate to. And then there were very compelling examples of families in poverty and how they can still go about raising kids who are grounded, generous, and money-wise. The tips and ideas and suggestions that were shared throughout the book can be used with kids of similar ages as they're illustrated in the book, or they could certainly be adapted for younger or older kids, and I thought that was helpful. And he stated that his purpose in writing this book was to just start some conversations in families, schools, and communities. And I absolutely got a sense of how reading this book could provide food for thought for families who are interested in raising money smart kids. There are some excellent examples of how parent-teacher groups have used ideas from the book, parent-teacher groups have used ideas, and then those have been recorded or reported in the book, so there are some real-life examples that way. I didn't really get the community connection, but certainly at the family level, most valuable, and secondarily at the school level. My first impression of the book, right away in the first chapter, and as we went chapter to chapter throughout the book, it got reinforced. Lieber wrote as much about parenting in this book as he did about teaching kids about money. So I think this book could be an excellent resource as a popular press on parenting as it is about money. Much of what he focused on was family values, personal virtues, character traits, and growing kids into responsible adults. And, of course, he used the financial piece of it on each of those topics, but those were the parenting components he was also writing about. Three major topics, saving, giving, and spending. Pretty much any time we're talking about kids and money, those are the topics you see. He spent some time talking about where the money comes from, whether it's an allowance, a gift, or work, and he does debate the merits of allowances, the pros and cons. So if we're looking at those three big topics that he covers, spend, give, and save, we'll start with spending, and he talks about right away who's paying for what, whether the kid's paying, the parents are paying, who's paying for what expenses at different parts of the lifespan. He related it directly to needs and wants. And because I sit here in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, home of Land's End, I thought it was really interesting that when he was looking at, a particular family was looking at who pays for what in terms of kids' clothing, they use what he called the Land's End line, And these parents were saying that Land's End has pretty affordable clothes and a good quality. And so if the kid wants what Land's End offers, they'll pay for it. But if the kid wants anything above what the Land's End line is, then they have to pay the difference. I'm wondering which kids are finding clothes at Land's End, because my kid wouldn't shop there. So I just thought that was an interesting illustration. In terms of spending, he does say that it's still okay for parents to have the rules and that the kids need to adhere to them, and that that's an important rule to establish, or an important tendency to establish early on with the kids. Let's see. Back to this parenting business. The broader than the financial lessons, the same three themes kept coming up throughout the book that I considered solid parenting tips: setting guidelines, modeling behaviors, and have family rituals related to the to their values. And you can think about that from a parenting perspective, but certainly as a way to encourage financial competence in your young person, in your child. I thought he had some good information on materialism, and that parents are pretty much the root of that with their children. And he also talked, he had some interesting ideas on delayed gratification that would be helpful for lots of parents to consider when kids are saying, I want, I need, or everybody has it. Under the giving topic, really important for parents to explain why and how they give. And I think about lots of families that I work with. They are generous in their own way and to their own causes or their own concerns, but how many of them have actually taken time to talk to their kids about the why or the how? He talks in this section about how to address tough topics when kids are seeing the haves and the have-nots, when kids are asking why we can't take the homeless person home and give that homeless person a home. Or another illustration he used was the response for the kid who, on the first day back from winter break, got home from school and said, Mom, didn't you know we were supposed to go on a ski trip over winter break like everybody else did? It's important to involve children, in this author's words, it's very important to involve children in household giving decisions, and back to that communication piece again, and then providing opportunities for them to give. For saving, very important to talk to kids about saving for what, and for parents to explain how they save, why parents save, why children should save, and then where that saving should occur. Should that be in a jar that they can see, or should it be in a bank, where it's more removed, but there's potential for interest. There's different strategies on that, too. All in all, I really enjoyed the book. It did provide perspective for my husband and I as we continue to parent our very own 14-year-old. I can see it as a good read for parents. Oftentimes when I have people in my office, they're looking at my bookshelf, and this is a book that I would have on my shelf. And I can also see that it might be a good read for colleagues in our Strengthening Young Families work group that we have on the Family Financial Security team. Questions?
Ruth, this is Mary Ann. What does the author say about how to handle allowances and, you know, working for an allowance versus you just get an allowance and being part of a family is that, yes, you do work in your home? Does he talk about that at all?
Yep, and he uses the latter. In his opinion, an allowance should be given to a child with strings attached and age appropriate, and the strings that this author would attach would be that some of that money is available for the child to spend. There is an expectation of giving or generosity, and there is an expectation to save, but that allowance is not tied to household tasks. He also gives other examples of families who tie those the day-to-day household activities with money, where the allowance is tied to the task. But in his opinion, there's normal household stuff that families contribute to because they live in the household, and then there is an allowance.
Okay, thank you.
Bruce, was there any kind of information in this book that talked about how the age of technology and digitalness have maybe contributed to some of this?
He talks a lot about the influence of social media and the immediacy of what kids have and what they have access to, the influence of commercials on what kids have and what they think they need versus what they want. So it's because it's current and he is parenting right now, he's seeing all of these influences. So that was kind of interesting.
Bruce, this is Colin. Could you give a little more sense of like what his research basis is or for some of these claims? Are they just like his like common sense or?
He calls it research because he has done extensive interviews and then through his interviews connected with other households or other authorities, lots of other authors. He cites lots and lots of other books in his bibliography, and pretty much every single one of them is also from the popular press. So he calls it research that he's basing his claims and his strategies on research. I would call it research very loosely defined.
Well, does he refer to any of the overindulgence research, like from Jean Elsley Clark or Dave Bredehoff? Because this is pretty consistent with that.
Not that I specifically recall. And
okay.
As I was going through the book, I was also making a list of the different publications he'd referred to. And that one doesn't jump out at me right now.
Okay.
Ruth, does he talk about banking and bank accounts for kids at all?
Yes, and that's something that he promotes for older kids, but he thinks that younger kids are so much more visual that the clear jar bank at home that says save on it is more age appropriate than this place that they just might drive by once in a while.
Great. All right, why don't we, thank you, Ruth. Why don't we move on to the last book, which is called Falling Short, and Chris is going to talk to us a bit about this book. The author here, one of the authors at least, is one of the, Alicia Munell, is one of the main retirement researchers and really has been at the forefront of retirement research for probably two decades. So this one's probably a little more academic than some other books, but I think she tried to have some co-authors and to make it more accessible. So, Chris, I'll let you take it from here.
Thanks, Michael. And as you were doing the introduction today and thinking about the content of this book, it may be in popular press, but I would guess that the general population would not want to read the book because of what it really says about retirement in the future, which is, as Michael said, well-researched and presented in this book, but doesn't present a really positive look at where we are right now in terms of retirement and the income that we will have. It's a really quick read book, and I approach this book as a person that's thinking about retirement in the next 10, 15, 20 years after reading the book or something like that, because many of my siblings and many friends have retired already, and they look at you going, well, when are you going to decide? Well, the book talks about 30 years ago, a whole different picture in terms of retirement. And at that time, people were stopping work in their early 60s, and they were looking at a long and comfortable retirement, or a golden age. But lots of things have happened in the last 30 years. It's making a difference, and it really comes down to that balancing of income and expense. In terms of income, we see that Social Security is facing some challenges with less and less income coming into that system. For pension plans, which were very, very popular in days gone by, are going by the wayside for many individuals. They were replaced with 401k plans, but individuals aren't necessarily taking advantage of those plans. And with as many changes in employers as we are seeing, many people have now, they're not building up a savings in a 401k plan and maybe cashing it in completely, if not turning it over to an IRA. And the third drop in income that we're seeing in terms of retirement is the change in health benefits. And many employers, I understand, used to offer health care benefits after retirement, and that's pretty much non-existent. On the flip side of that income and expense equation, people are living longer, there's rising healthcare costs, and the interest rates that we were seeing in the 70s and I should say the 80s and the 90s are no longer in existence. So we're now talking about people living 20 to 30 years after they retire, and that's going to take much more expenses. The book is, like I said, a really fast read. It breaks the content down into four focus areas, the first being how bad is the problem, how we got there, what individuals can do, and that what we can do as a nation. So let me just highlight a couple of points, because it was a really good read for me, really interesting. If you want to know the history of how we got there, this is a book I'd highly recommend. But when you start reading some of the content and look at where you are with savings and our inability to know how long we're going to live, that's when it gets to be a tougher read. And I just feel lucky that we have saved our entire lifetime, that we can look at retirement, because the authors are saying not everybody is going to be able to retire. The goal, as presented by the authors, to basically stay the same financially in retirement as you did during your working years, is to be able to have an income, a monthly income of 75% of what you have during your working years. That's difficult to do because of the factors I mentioned before. And the recommendation that we oftentimes see about individuals taking out 4% of their savings on an annual basis for retirement is not filling the gap between what Social Security is now providing and what's predicted for that. Another piece that I found really interesting, and again, thinking about how things have changed over time, is that retirement really is not a long-standing tradition. It's something that came to be more in the 20th century than before that. But people in the past stopped working when they were no longer able to work, and because we had an agrarian population at that time too, more so than in the 20th century, their farm was wealth, and they had security by selling that farm. But as we became more industrialized, there wasn't an equity to cash in at retirement to see you through the rest of your years. So as I mentioned, we're finding that less than half of the working population right now has a pension plan that they're relying on, and Social Security right now providing 40% of your pre-retirement income, decreasing into the 30% and perhaps lower by the year 2055. That's why I said people facing retirement may start reading this book and then get discouraged as they read it. What we can do, they give us three options in the book in facing retirement, is to either plan to be poor, second, start saving more now, or plan to work longer. And actually, they recommend a combination of saving more and working longer so that you do have adequate funds for retirement. And while working longer may not sound appealing for people that, like me, who have seen colleagues retire at 55 and 60 and so on. The book makes a good point of how healthier we are right now, and the kind of jobs that we have now. They're less demanding physically than jobs of the past. So those 55 retirement years aren't necessarily necessary as they were in the past. In terms of what we can do as a nation, one of the things that's recommended is to promote the age of 70 as full retirement instead of even suggesting the early eligibility age of 62. The authors recommend that that early eligibility age raise at least to the age of 64. And there's both financial benefits for individuals who put off Social Security now and in the future, but also that whole idea of, as a nation, what we need to do to maintain financial security for our aging population. To encourage people to work longer, though, too, it encourages on an individual and a national basis that older workers be encouraged to master technical skills, remain flexible and think young, and keep with the same employer because they know your skills and abilities. So it was a really good read for me, an interesting read. And one of the quotes on the back of the book that really struck home with me was, America's retirement saving system has failed. Too many people are retiring with too little to live on. This book nails the changes and incentives needed to restore an aging generation to fiscal health. Both voter and policymakers should read it. So, again, a good read for me. It made me glad that I've saved my lifetime, but also makes me think, how long am I going to live, and how do I want to live that? So, Michael, I'm sorry. 5 minutes left. But no, any questions for me? Any questions for me? The book also brought home some of the things that we've talked about or we talk about in that if you have a choice between savings for retirement or supporting your child through college, build a retirement, and look at your home as equity, not as inheritance for someone else.
Chris, you mentioned that 4% formula, you know, to plan mm-hmm. to live, or withdraw 4% of your retirement savings so that it'll go in perpetuity till you die.
Right.
And people love formulas and rules of thumb. Did the author have any more of those kind of mental shortcuts for people for planning?
One of them was to think about savings. Have a savings of 6 to 11 times your current earnings to maintain the standard of living that you have right now. 6 to 11 times your current earnings. And yes, there were a couple more in there. That's one that stuck out for me, as well as the more complete information about what, if you hold off on claiming Social Security from 62 to age 70, that'll be a 76% increase in what your Social Security benefit will be. So in the long run, again, and because people are living longer, that's a variable that's so hard to factor in, how long you need to stretch those dollars out. It's a hard one to be able to answer definitively. It did mention, too, and I don't know too much about this one, but the My RA automatic savings option that's been proposed, and I that was an interesting thing to having a required retirement fund put in place, but I don't think that's in the works quite yet.
All right, any other questions either for Chris about this book or just general thoughts or comments about these books altogether, or even suggestions of other books that you might think about picking up in addition to these four over the summer?
Well, for our book reviewers, I'm just wondering, with the books that you did look at, What, if anything, will you do differently with your financial education because of that book?
This is Ruth, and I guess for mine, it just really reinforced the fact that regardless of how much we have, it's how we feel about it and what we choose to do with it, and then how we communicate that to our kids. And I think that's the message that I want to make sure that I share with the individuals and the families that I meet with, that oftentimes we meet with people who don't have a lot. On the other hand, I meet with people who seem to have more than they need, but it's what we do with it, how we feel about it, how we communicate that to our kids.
This is Mary Ann. I think the one thing when I'm working with clients that I would do differently is just try to help them get that positive twist or that positive thoughts around their debt, that everyone has debt, so it's how you manage it, and, you know, that, yes, you're able to manage it. Kind of, so giving them the power or empowering them a little bit more. Sometimes I think I maybe go into it very, okay, let's get this on paper, you know, let's hit the pavement here and work on this, but I think maybe setting that up ahead of time or being a little bit more relational before we do that. What's your income? What's your expenses? So that's what I think I would change.
And this is Chris, and I think it's helping people just think through really what they want and what they need now and in the future. That was one of the takeaway pieces I have, that you need to think through a lifetime of what you want and what's important to you, and not what everybody else has been able to do or achieve.
That's great. Thank you all. Colin will let you off the hook because Terry's not here either. But thanks for sharing.
All right. We have just 1 minute left. I don't know if anybody else has any other final questions or comments.
I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to do this. It's a great way to read differently and get connected with what's out there.
Great. Well, as I said in the beginning, the audio recording of today's call will be on the Lunchtime Learning website, which is the fyi.uwex.edu/financial series. So these will all be up here. I thank all of our reviewers for taking the time to read these books and share their thoughts with colleagues, and I thank all the colleagues for being here today, for being able to ask some questions and to hear about these books. And I encourage you all to read something, maybe not one of these four, but as Chris said, it's always good to get a new perspective and to gain some insights from what's out there. And sometimes these popular press books, we may wonder whether they're really research-based or not, but they help us think, and so it can be a way to, in addition to the fun reading that we might do over the summer, do some reading and help us think a little bit about our work and careers as well. So thanks, everybody, for another great year of the Lunchtime Learning Series. I think in the fall we're going to try to mix it up with some different formats and styles, but I appreciate you hanging with us for this year. Thanks, and have a great summer.